From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This August, the U.S. reached a new record, adding jobs for the 66th straight month. Despite the good news, many workers are still unable to find jobs, and some are dropping out of the workforce, discouraged by too many rejections. We'll look at that as well as how employers see the job market and new pushes for a higher minimum wage. This hour on Point, the American job market, the numbers, and the everyday reality. You can join us on air or online. Are you looking for work? If so, how's it going? What steps are you taking to find a job? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Washington is Heather Boucher. She is executive director and chief economist at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth, an organization that researches economic inequality, and senior fellow as well at the Center for American Progress. Heather Boucher, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Thank you. And with me in the studio in Boston is Alicia Sasser Modestino. She is professor of economics and public policy at Northeastern University, where she is associate director of the Dukakis Center for Urban and Regional Policy. Alicia, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Jane. It's nice to be here.
So we'll start with the unemployment rate at 5.1%. That's down to a seven-year low. Here's President Obama speaking last Wednesday at Macomb Community College outside Detroit, talking about the consistent improvement in the American job growth.
66 straight months of job creation. So the unemployment rate is now at 5.1%, which is the lowest it's been since April of 2008.
Heather Boucher, start us off here and tell us about these most recent job numbers and how they fit into the picture of the labor market this year.
Well, it's certainly good news that we've continued to see employment growth month after month for 66 months. That's certainly a good sign. And it certainly is important that the unemployment rate has continued to fall. However, there's a lot of other indications in the labor market that we still have a long ways to go to have the kind of economy that's creating enough jobs for everyone who wants them and at the kinds of wages that people need to be seeing. So one statistic that I look to every month when the jobs numbers come out is the share of Americans who actually have a job. The unemployment rate measures the number of people who are actively seeking a job and who want one. But the share of Americans at work really tells you how tight the labor market is in a kind of different way. And what we see there is that the share of Americans who actually have a job today still remains far below where it was in 2007 and even below where it was in the 2000s before the peak of 2007. And that's a very strong indication that things aren't all well out there in the labor market for American workers and their families.
So the numbers may be down, Alicia, but they don't take into account these little details, right? And the fact that many Americans who've dropped out of the market, they're just simply not job hunting anymore.
Yeah, the declining labor force participation that we've seen since even before the Great Recession started reflects a number of factors. And in general, economists have found that about half of what's going on with lower labor force participation rate can be attributed to demographic factors. So we've seen the retirement of the baby boom generation, perhaps interrupted a little bit during the Great Recession as folks hung in there to boost their nest eggs up again, but again, you know, continued its decline as that generation exits the labor force. And then in addition, we've seen younger workers increasing their educational attainment, delaying their entry into the labor market. So those factors also come into play, but it's still a question for prime age workers why we don't see as many of them in the labor force now as we did before. Mm.
This issue is certainly coming up on the campaign trail. Here's Bernie Sanders speaking at a rally last month at the University of Washington in Seattle, explaining what he thinks the term unemployment actually means.
Real unemployment is not the 5.3%, which the newspapers report. That's official unemployment. Real unemployment includes those people who have given up looking for work and the millions of people who are working part-time where they want to work full-time.
And here's Matt Guido, a software testing engineer for 18 years until he was laid off in 2011. In this interview with Fox 32 News in Illinois, Matt describes his job search process.
It is a big black mark on your record when you're unemployed for a long time because you're seen as, what's wrong with you? Why aren't you good enough to work? I never anticipated being out of work for 4 years. I don't think anyone really does. And it's very frustrating. because you know you can do a job. But people don't want to give you a chance past a certain time. Past a certain time, questions change from what have you been doing to why haven't you been doing things?
Why haven't you been doing things? Heather Boucher, a lot of people hearing that.
Certainly. I mean, these are the sad stories that we hear so often that we're still hearing, even though we've seen 66 months of continuous job gains, that, you know, for those folks who lost their job during the Great Recession, one of the things that we saw was that the duration of how long people were spending out of work rose to historic highs. We'd never seen people out of work for so long, going back to the end of World War II. And as a result, you have a lot of folks who've had a really hard time making it back into that labor market. Especially when we think about older workers, there are a lot of folks who lost their jobs who were between the ages of 50 and maybe 60 years old, who quite frankly will, the evidence is showing, really have never been able to make it back in. So we could call that quote unquote early retirement, or we could call that being forced out by an economy that wasn't performing during the Great Recession. All of this really points to the fact that we need to be looking at the share of Americans who actually have a job. And until that number returns back to where it had been, until it is that that the share of people who are actually in the workforce with a job comes back up, we can't sort of, you know, wash our hands of recovering from the Great Recession.
Do you agree with that, Alicia?
Yes. And I think also that we've seen it. It's important to also look at what employers are doing on their side of the table. So we've seen a lot of people who have been out of work for a long time. And we also went through a period where labor was completely abundant, right? It was very easy to go out into the market and find the perfect worker. You could write whatever job description you wanted and get a worker who would fulfill that. And indeed, some of the research that I've done using online job posting shows that we saw a tremendous increase in skill requirements during the Great Recession on the part of employers. So the share of employers requiring a bachelor's degree for jobs that previously did not increased by 10 percentage points between 2007 and 2010. The share of employers requiring more than 2 years of experience for jobs that used to only require maybe a year of experience increased by roughly the same amount. As we've gotten farther into the recovery, we have seen a reversion in these skill requirements, but it's been much smaller than the run-up. And so now we're finding that as employers are reporting that they can't find the skilled workers they're looking for, some of them are starting to scale back on those requirements, but only a fraction of them compared to the big run-up that we saw during the recession.
Talk more about that, Heather, these open jobs. The unemployment numbers are at a seven-year low, but these record number of open jobs, that's another story. They've surged to a record high this summer. What's going on there?
Well, it's really interesting. And in preparation for today, I printed out a graph that looks at that. So I can't show the listeners the graph, but let me describe to you this very interesting trend, which is that you're right. The number of job openings is up. And Alicia's research on what employers are looking for is very interesting. And how long people are keeping those ads up is another piece of this story. You see this spike in job openings that actually does not follow the same trend as hires or quits. So it looks like from the data, what we're seeing is employers are posting jobs, you know, just sort of saying, hey, maybe we'll find the right person, maybe we won't, but we're going to put this ad up right now. And it doesn't seem to indicate a real urgency to actually go out and snatch up that worker and hire them, because if that was the case, we would see the rate of hiring actually commensurate with this sharp uptick in job openings. Now, some of this in I would be actually interested to hear Alicia's reaction to this. Some of this may be the new ways that people are searching for jobs. You know, they're no longer looking, posting jobs in the newspaper where it costs money to post an ad. But now with a lot of online ways, some of which can be free, of actually posting for employment, that may be some of the issue. I'm not actually sure. But I do think that this is it indicates that there are some signs of tightening, but there seems to be some lingering weakness below it, because you don't see the run-up in hiring.
This notion that the labor market is unable to supply the people that companies need is a real problem.
Yeah, and I think Heather's right that we've seen a big change in terms of the hiring process and the technology that goes along with it. So as we've moved a lot of job posting and resume posting online, and especially during the Great Recession where you know, employers were getting hundreds or thousands of resumes for every job posting, they've changed the technology about how they sift through those resumes. And so there are a ton of online filters. There are a lot of pre-employment tests that are now being given at the application stage, where if you have one wrong answer or if you don't meet the exact requirements, employers don't even see your resume. It just gets, you know, tossed in the trash, essentially. And you were seeing a little bit of a backlash among employers and among hiring agencies that are saying, wow, we can't find the people we're looking for. Maybe we actually have to go back out and talk to them again, or look, have people look through some of these resumes instead of doing so much automatic screening. But I think also that Heather is right in terms of, you know, as we've seen vacancies increase, but hires have not, where is the urgency? And I think the one thing that economists look towards in terms of urgency is wages. And we just really haven't seen wages take off the way we should, perhaps at a 5.1% unemployment rate.
Right. We haven't seen wages go up right as unemployment goes down, Heather.
Exactly. I mean, I think as that is exactly where this conversation needs to go, because if employers actually felt that they needed folks, they would actually start increasing wages, both to retain the employees that they currently have on staff and also to lure that top talent over to their firm. And that is not what we're seeing in any way, shape, or form in this labor market today. The trends are actually very disheartening. And, you know, when you look at one of the biggest economic problems facing America today, it is this secular decline in incomes for middle-class families, in no part due to a lack of tightening of wages.
I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the job market, the record number of open jobs, but still the large number of people seeking work. We're speaking this hour with Heather Boucher, Executive Director and Chief Economist at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth, and Alicia Sasser-Modestino, Professor of Economics and Public Policy at Northeastern University here in Boston. Here's U.S. Secretary of Labor Thomas Perez speaking about the Labor Department's latest numbers on employment. Here he is in an interview last week on CNBC. He talks about what it indicates about the U.S. economy.
This is a record high in terms of job openings, and the job openings are in the sectors that pay very well, like business and professional services. In the depths of the recession, we had roughly 7 job seekers for every job opening. Now we have 1.4. And I'm not a math major. I'd rather compete, though, with one person than 6 people.
Okay, job openings, more people looking. Alicia, talk to us about this. Are employers more picky? Are workers just lacking the skills that they need in these certain areas? What is it?
Yeah, I think that there's a little bit of evidence on both sides, I would say. I think it's a little bit more of a nuanced story. A lot of times when we see job openings rising ahead of hires, we do get concerned about whether or not there's a mismatch in the labor market. So, for example, when labor is plentiful, employers become accustomed to hiring a particular caliber of candidates with specific training or level of experience. However, when the labor market tightens, the number of job applicants is likely to shrink, and employers have difficulty finding the same caliber of candidates. So from the employer's perspective, a shortage or mismatch of workers exists. From the economist's perspective, the existence of a shortage is somewhat questionable because a job could be filled by another qualified, if not ideal, worker. Hmm. Now, as I mentioned before, we saw a big increase in skill requirements between 2007 and 2010. We've seen some of that start to reverse itself between 2010 and 2014, but we've only seen a partial reversion. And in part, this is likely because some employers perhaps were able to be opportunistic and find a more skilled worker during the Great Recession. But others may have actually changed the nature of the jobs that they were hiring for. So, for example, if you cut back on the number of workers that you had in your establishment, perhaps you've asked those workers to now do a different set of tasks, and you actually do need a higher level of skill. And so what we found is about 30% of the growth in skill levels within occupations this upskilling was related to employers being opportunistic because there is a larger pool of skilled workers out there. But that means that about two-thirds of it is fairly sticky. And it's a question that as the labor market tightens, will we see more of these skill requirements reverse themselves, or will they be here to stay? Hmm. And then that means setting the bar higher, perhaps, for those workers who are sitting on the sidelines.
Mm. How do you see it, Heather? That's interesting.
Well, I agree with Alicia to some extent. I do think, though, that wages are a really important indicator of the tightness that employers are seeing in the labor market. And we just don't see signs there that they are actually experiencing that kind of urgency that they feel the need to start raising wages. So I have to question, how much – I mean, I'm certain that there is some mix of skills and the changing ways that employers have done things, but the fact that we aren't seeing pressure on wages really is a very fundamental indicator that employers aren't going out there and feeling like, oh, I really need to get this person in place so that I can meet my demand, right? Because if you are running a business and you've got customers coming in the door, or you've got sales that you need to make or things that you need to do, you need that person in place, and you don't have the time necessarily to wait for the perfect person. And one, a clear economic variable that indicates that you really need to get that done is that you're willing to pay somebody a little bit higher, draw them from a different firm, poach them. And we're not seeing that. And we're not just not seeing it in terms of wages. We're not seeing it in terms of benefit packages as well. So I think that there's a question in terms of how much of this is on the fault of, or how much we can blame on skills or some sort of skills mismatch versus a real fundamental challenge, which is that it seems like we're not seeing the kind of demand out there that would drive the kind of hiring that we need to see to get everyone back to work.
And this is a debate beyond minimum wage, which we'll talk about later, right?
Far and above beyond the minimum wage, because these challenges go all the way up the wage distribution. Today, the median family, the typical family in America, still has incomes that are far lower than they were prior to the Great Recession. You have profits that have gone up and up, so firms are doing really well, but they're not feeling that urgency to get people back to work. And one indication of that is that they're not paying higher wages in order to lure people in.
Let's get some listeners in here. So many waiting to join the conversation. Kathy first in Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Kathy. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Yes, I just wanted to say that I find the biggest problem that I'm running into is I feel it's ageism, and I really don't understand how anyone can tell how old I am from my resume when I send out resumes to various employers other than just the length of experience I have. So I feel I know that I'm underemployed just being employed part-time right now. Yeah. And am just running into blockades. And as far as the application process goes, I just think it's gotten rather ridiculous, all the hoops that you have to jump through.
Kathy, thank you so much for the call. Alicia, what about this? Are certain age groups struggling more in the job market?
Well, we've definitely seen that it's been harder for older workers to get back into the labor market once they have lost their job. That certainly happened during the Great Recession and in the recovery. If you had a job and you kept it, you're fine. But once you've been thrown out, it's hard to get back in. And you'd really be surprised at the ways that employers can tell a lot of things about you from your resume, even if you don't have, say, your birth date on there. So, for example, if you have a Hotmail email address, you're probably from my generation or older. If you have a Gmail address, you're probably a little bit younger. But in addition to that, as I said before, there's just a lot of different screens employers have put on now where they're looking for, that very special, magical candidate that is going to be job ready from day one and also, have all of the teamwork and communication skills and motivation and drive and innovation. It's really become, it's been a buyer's market for some time.
Heather Boucher, here's Aaron from Facebook, has the same question. How is the aging workforce affecting the number of people dropping out of the labor market? It seems that the large number of retiring baby boomers would be a major reason for the number of people who've stopped looking for work.
Well, I mean, I'll echo what Alicia said. You know, certainly you've seen things much tougher for folks at the older end of the labor market. It's been very hard for people to get back in, and there's evidence that you do see discrimination out there in terms of what employers are looking for. Some of the harder things that I think employers think about with older workers is that they have higher salary expectations. I mean, people want to get the salary at the job that they had before they lost their job. And oftentimes, because of seniority, you've got to pay them those higher salaries. And again, we don't see evidence that employers are willing to do that. You also see issues around management, if someone younger is managing them, and these sorts of questions. But it all indicates that we are still in an economy where we are not seeing the level of economic demand that is really putting things enough fire under the economy to get everyone back to work. And you're seeing this play out for more vulnerable populations, for folks who are older, and we're also seeing it play out for younger workers as well. I will just note one thing that we've been talking around in this conversation is this question of whether or not employees show up on day one, quote unquote, job ready. Do they have all the skills? Does the employer need to invest nothing to get them up to speed? And you know, that should be a real flag that there's something wrong in our labor market. If employers only want that quote unquote perfect person who's job ready, that means that all of the responsibility for getting job ready is being increasingly pushed onto the backs of workers and their families. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our public education and broader educational systems to actually do that training for people, because employers really are not making those investments in the same way that they were generations ago. People aren't keeping their jobs for as long, and employers aren't making those long-term investments to hire someone in and then get them ready to do their job. And that really indicates a shift in how we're thinking about what it is that people need to succeed. And I think for me, at least, it opens up very important questions, whether or not that's really possible over the long term for all that responsibility to not fall onto employers, but to fall on individuals and to communities to prepare them for these jobs.
Let's go to Steve in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Steve. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Hi. Fine. Go ahead.
My situation, I worked at IBM, and I had been there a couple of years, and in that time there was like six or seven rather large layoffs, which had me concerned. And you had talked about older workers, and I'm an older worker in my late 50s, and I just thought it was better for me to be proactive and look for something else before I lost a job. As you talked about, I just think it's hard being older in the job market, so I couldn't find anything full-time to kind of take the place of that. So I'm working three jobs now.
Three part-time jobs, right?
Yeah. Yes, three part-time jobs. And you don't see a lot of benefits out there. I work for the city here in Dubuque, and one of the things is that there's a limit to full-time work. So you take the part-time job and then try to fill in with some other part-time jobs around it. And I think you see more and more of that out there.
I do too. Steve, thank you so much. Alicia, speak to that. Steve's point, what about all these part-time workers, the freelancers that are stringing together jobs? How do they play into this?
Yeah, well, I think that now that we're in the gig economy, where workers are not only taking part-time jobs or many part-time jobs, but now are taking contractor type positions, I think the genie's out of the bottle. So I think during the Great Recession, we kind of had a confluence of factors that just made it so easy for this gig economy to arise, right? We had changes in technology where we could be linking people to provide services with those who demanded it. We also had a lot of people who were out of work, who were desperate to make ends meet. And now, you know, that responsibility for employing oneself has shifted a little more towards the worker than the employer. Mm-hmm. We've also seen, you know, healthcare costs leveled out for a while during the Great Recession, but now they're resuming their trajectory as well. So the incentive to hire a full-time person that you provide benefits for is a little bit less. Mm.
Zeke in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Zeke, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Jane, thank you.
Hello.
Put me on. Heather and the rest of the guests, very well-educated sounding woman, and no econ, so I'll spare the lecture on Keynesian or supply-side economics. I also hold an econ degree, but I'm the exact person we're talking about. I'm 55 years old. not able to work. I just want to portray to them, because they cannot know this. It's basically over. I mean, we can lament how bad things are, but nothing will change, because at this particular time, employees get to choose great employees, and they don't need them. They are able to terrorize their current employees, saying, hey, you better do this job with somebody else, because or else you're out. So there's this function going on here. They don't need to hire new workers, and they won't, because they're at an all-time profit. And they're, you know, they're the human resources professionals are six-figure people now. So the point being that there is hope, maybe like the guy who heard Bernie Sanders, of like what he recalls the employer of last resort. If there was a large-scale employment by the government, which, you know, today's thing with all these Fox News, people hate that word, government jobs, but you could really change the economy, because you would have an influx of disposable income, and subsequently all these corporations would have increased profits. But it's not going to happen.
Zeke, thank you so much. I'll let you respond, Alicia Sasser-Modestino.
Well, I think to some extent, Zeke is right that employers just don't feel that urgency that we've been talking about. And, you know, Heather's mentioned several times now that what we really need is incredibly strong demand to be able to push up wages and to light a fire under employers. But what's interesting is when you do see rapidly increasing demand, we have seen employers reversing their skill requirements. So, for example, in North Dakota, where we saw the fracking boom, we saw employees and workers flooding into the mining there to earn the higher salaries. And what happened to the surrounding states and to employers in the surrounding states in occupations such as construction, production, truck driving, et cetera, is that they had to lower their skill requirements. And so they had to now, instead of requiring, 5 years experience as a detailed construction worker, as long as you can hold the hammer, come on in, we're ready for you. But it takes an incredibly strong demand to produce that effect.
Heather Boucher, what are the kinds of jobs where we are seeing the most growth, the most opportunity in this American job market?
Well, one of the sectors that has continued to show strong job gains has been in healthcare, probably in no small part due to the Affordable Care Act, which has expanded healthcare availability. And with that, you need more healthcare providers. But, you know, some of the places where we've seen slowing job gains in recent months has been in retail and construction, places where you would expect faster job gains if the economy was as strong as we wanted it to be. And, of course, one of the places where we've seen job losses, which gets in some level to, I think, some comments that Steve noted, he was working, it sounded like, for the city in Iowa, is that we've seen losses all across the country in state and local employment. And so that has been a real drag on the economy since the end of the Great Recession, where state and local governments have been paring back, which means both that they're paring back on services and educational opportunities and the kinds of things that could help workers get the skills they need in order to be the kinds of workers that Alicia keeps talking about that employers want to see. But on the other hand, also means that you've got a lot of folks out of work and a lot of opportunities that just aren't available at the state and local level. And that has been dragging down state and local economies all across the country. So there have been, you know, some bright spots. And again, you know, healthcare really being the shining star. But there have been some other places where we haven't seen the kind of employment gains that one would expect, given where we are at this point in the economic cycle.
I agree. Alicia?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, healthcare is one of the bright spots. Also, you know, computer, mathematical science, a lot of those STEM occupations are bright spots as well. And I think, you know, Heather's right in terms of thinking about the kinds of jobs that workers are prepared to do. And one of the things that we've been looking at is just in terms of the lack of information that's out there, right, that leads many individuals, particularly in the middle of the labor market here, where they're looking for some kind of post-secondary credential or an associate's degree to get that healthcare technician job, which is in high demand. And a lot of times they just don't have the right information, or they're not prepared for that program. They end up taking out a lot of loans. And so I think what the Obama administration has just done in terms of providing greater transparency for some of these education programs will be important for individuals to make more informed choices.
I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the American job market this hour, American wages and job openings. We're speaking this hour with Heather Boucher, Executive Director and Chief Economist at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth, and Alicia Sasser-Modestino, Professor of Economics and Public Policy at Northeastern University. Let's go to Stephanie in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Stephanie. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks.
Yes.
Just a quick comment, and I'll take my response off the air. So your guests have their finger right on the pulse and are quite accurate in their assessment of what's going on today. I'm with my firm now for 8 years. I'm a marketing professional with an advanced master's degree. I have survived a couple of layoffs, and wages are flat for me for now the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, my firm has implemented something that's kind of an interesting dynamic. While I'm appreciative of it, it still is indicative of no urgency about increasing wages. There is, for those who would be in a merit situation for an annual increase, a bonus at the end of the year. Mm. But I have looking for other employment because I need to increase my wages because, as everyone knows, hard costs are up. Insurance is more.
So she gets a bonus there at the end of the year, Stephanie, but here we go again. There's no sense of urgency from employers to raise wages, Alicia.
Yeah, and we've definitely seen that in the wage trends that have been emerging, where even the latest wage data, we're seeing very, very small increases. One of the places that we have seen wages increasing is when we have passed higher minimum wage ordinances. And so some recent data from the job vacancy survey in Minnesota, states do their individual job vacancy surveys, or at least 12 of them do, shows that they are seeing modest increases in pay for professional workers, but an even bigger increase, about 7.5% over the last 12 months for low-wage workers who are at the 25th percentile of the distribution. So that means the bottom 25% of workers there. And they attribute it to the rise in the minimum wage there, which increased to $8 in 2014 and then to $9 an hour at the beginning of August.
Hmm. So positive, a positive sign.
That is the one place that we're seeing wages increases when we mandate them.
Let's get into this minimum wage debate a little bit more and bring in Harry Holzer, Senior Fellow in Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution and Professor at the McCourt School of Public Policy at Georgetown. Harry, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Jane. It's good to be here.
So, but a lot of conversation about this $15 an hour minimum wage increase in many places. What's your position on the fight for 15?
Well, I tend to support President Obama's proposal to raise the federal minimum up to 10 and index it to inflation. I certainly support most states that on their own go up to 10 or a bit less than 10, but I don't support going to 15. I think that's too high. You know, it's very nice to be able to pass a law and say everybody should have higher wages, but there is a trade-off, as there usually is in economics. If you force the price of something higher, while its quality stays the same, people usually buy less. If you force the wages of workers higher, and that's the price of labor, employers will likely hire less. Now, the big question is, well, how much? And what's the size of that trade-off? We've had hundreds of studies of this issue in the United States and elsewhere. Most studies find a modest negative effect on employment when you have a moderate or a modest bump up in the minimum wage of 20-30%. There's a set of studies that don't find any negative effect. There's another set of studies that find really big effects. If you average all of the credible studies together, you get this modest drop in employment. So, you know, the Congressional Budget Office, I thought, did a very nice report about a year and a half ago, saying what would happen if the Obama administration's proposal of $10 went into effect. And they said their best estimate was we'd lose about 500,000 jobs over 3 years, although many millions of people would have wage bumps. That was a trade-off I could live with. I was willing to sacrifice that number of jobs. And of course, and there's a lot of uncertainty about how exactly this plays out. But I think going up to 15, many millions of workers would not have the skills that employers want to see before they hire somebody at $15 an hour. And I think the job losses would be much, much bigger.
Let's hear from Democratic Governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, on this issue. Here he is speaking at a rally for the $15 an hour minimum wage in New York City, being increased to that amount on Thursday, flanked by Vice President Joe Biden. He voiced his opinion on how to treat workers in the state of New York.
Every working man and woman in the state of New York deserves $15 an hour as a minimum wage, and we're not going to stop until we get it done.
And here's Vice President Joe Biden explaining the wide-reaching benefits of raising the minimum wage.
We know that boosting the minimum wage has a rippling effect on the entire wage scale, benefiting workers with wages up to 50% higher than minimum wage. So you get a minimum wage working at one of the fast food outlets, guess what? The manager's salary goes up. Everybody's salary goes up.
What about that, Harry Holzer? There's a ripple effect on the entire wage scale with an increase in minimum wage.
Well, I'm really not sure it's on the entire wage scale. I do believe that there's a ripple effect at the bottom. So if the minimum wage covers, let's say, the bottom 10% of workers, my guess is you'd get a ripple up through 15% or something like that. I don't think it affects workers at the top. But my problem with the Cuomo proposal is that it's going to $15 an hour for fast food workers only, which to me doesn't make a lot of sense. It was like the D.C. proposal to have a much higher minimum wage for big box stores, and I remember which didn't go into effect, but Walmart said, that's great, we won't come. Why single out this one industry when you leave out other restaurants, other hospitality, other retail trade? What you'd likely have happening when that goes into effect is, number one, if the prices go up at those fast food restaurants, people will switch to other kinds of restaurants and other kinds of hospitality. And number two, I think you'll see many of those franchisees relocating to other states where their costs aren't that high. So that concept of getting all excited about applying a minimum wage to this very small sector really, to me, doesn't make a lot of economic sense.
Heather Boucher, speak to this. Speak to Harry Holzer here. The increase in minimum wage will actually produce a drop in employment in this country.
Well, I think it's a good question. I think Harry was very his analysis of that was very subtle, right? He said that the evidence shows that raising the minimum wage moderately will possibly include an employment decline, but it's small. One might say that there's questions about whether or not it's economically meaningful. The CBO, the Congressional Budget Office study that he cited, actually included a zero employment event effect within what a statistician would call the confidence interval, meaning that they couldn't sort of discern that having no employment effect was actually well within the analysis, even though the estimate was about losing about 500,000 jobs. So I think that there are some questions. I think there are two big issues here that are really quite striking. One is that people out there in America seem to want this. You're seeing a lot of politicians, a lot of labor advocates, a lot of working class people stand up and say, you know what, we want higher wages and we want government to take action on it. And this has also been alongside these fights for higher wages within certain sectors of the economy, you know, focusing on union organizing and pushing employers. So I think our job as economists is not necessarily to tell the people out there in America exactly what they should do, but to give them the range of what the likely economic implications are of this policy. So I would refrain from saying, no, we shouldn't do this. I think that our job is to say, oh, there could be costs and benefits. Let me talk about some of the benefits of raising the minimum wage,
to
a higher level.
Heather, yes. Let me get this sound in here first. Let me just hear from an average American here who's making or who wants to make $15 an hour here on April 15th, tax day. Paula Gibbs protesting outside of a Burger King in Atlanta, explaining in an interview that she needs a larger wage to take care of her family.
We go out every day to take care of everyone else's family so they can make a living wage. And all we're asking for is a living wage so we can take care of our families the same.
Harry Hulser, what do you say to that? What do you say to someone like Paula Gibbs?
Well, I'd say a couple things, and I'd actually say one thing to Heather. Heather said that in the CBO study, zero employment effect was within the confidence interval, but so was the law, a much larger loss. So was a loss of a million jobs. So it's a slightly one-sided view of the evidence. What I would say to the person who just spoke is that, yes, we would all like those people to have higher wages, but forcing them up without any change in skills or productivity won't necessarily accomplish that. And the other thing, people forget, most people who work at the minimum wage are not poor. And not low income. You know, there's broadly three groups who work at the minimum wage. Young people, which I define as being up to, say, below the age of 25. Second earners in middle income families, as well as poor adults. And what happens if the poor adults are the ones who lose their jobs? Or what happens when we make it even harder than it is today for young people to get their foot in the labor market? That's a real cost. And if someone asks me my opinion, I would say that the risks of those costs are too high.
Alicia Modestino, jump in here.
Yeah, so back in 2013 in Massachusetts, we had a debate about raising the minimum wage, and all of the same arguments came up. And I would say, in general, I think Heather's right in terms of we need to provide a range of estimates to policymakers to say, here are the potential employment effects. You decide what's the acceptable trade-off. And I would say that one reason sometimes why a lot of these studies find, quote-unquote, no effect is that exactly because people want this, because we've seen the minimum wage erode so much over time that we increase the minimum wage essentially when we can afford to do so. And this speaks a little bit to Harry's point that you know, he initially said he supported increasing the minimum wage to, say, $10 an hour, but he thought 15 was too much. And so as economists, you know, one of our jobs is to provide this range of estimates. And I just wanted to bring some data into this where a recent Upshot piece in The New York Times just listed the ratio of the minimum wage to the projected median wage in different cities. And cities that had a high ratio where the minimum wage would be approaching the median wage were Washington and Boston, Seattle, New York, places where we see minimum wages being increased. And those where it would be exceeding or being very close to the median wage are places like New Orleans, Oklahoma City, Miami. Mm-hmm. And so the problem with the federal minimum wage is trying to set one wage bar across all labor markets. And we know that labor markets vary
very geographically.
Time is of the essence here. Let's get to Rose in Georgetown, Kentucky. Rose, thank you for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I had a couple of comments.
Okay.
One is I've not heard much discussion about multi-tier or a two-tier. Obviously, a high school student, a first-year college student, is not worth what someone with experience has. I don't know why they're not discussing, you know, he talked about the three groups of, you know, of people who work for minimum wage, and a lot of them aren't poor people. A lot of them are students who live at home, or a lot of them are second earners.
So what about the multi-tiered wages? Rose, I hear you. Thank you so much for bringing this up. Let's see. Heather, would you respond to this?
Well, that's an issue that comes up time and time again when we talk about the minimum wage. You know, there's challenges to doing it. You know, one point, though, that both Rose brought up and that Harry brought up is this idea that the second earner isn't an important contributor to economic, to the family economy. And that actually couldn't be further from the truth in today's economy. Most families have both earners in the labor market up and down the income spectrum. They're not working for the traditional so-called pin money that is for, you know, just for fun or something. They're working because their families need that income, because they need it to pay the rent. They need it to put food on the table. So I think that's a little bit of a problem. And that gets to this question of who decides this two-tier and you know, which workers are you going to sort of push down to the bottom? The reality is that a higher minimum wage will encourage employers to use those workers more productively. It will encourage them to reduce turnover. And even, you know, with a teenager, keeping that person on a few extra months or giving them that higher wage that keeps them in that job a few extra months at a fast food restaurant is going to improve their productivity. It's going to be good for business.
Harry, how do you see that? Do you agree?
Not completely. I'm open to the idea of having a sub-minimum for young people, which I think actually would help them preserve more of their jobs when otherwise they might be the ones not hired. What Heather said is true, that when the wage goes up, it is true that employers work a little harder to reduce turnover and things like that. But again, going up to $15 an hour, to me, the more likely scenario is that they raise their hiring standards, and people whom they are willing to hire at $7, $8, $9 an hour, they're simply not willing to hire at $15, at least not legally and on the books. And they raise their productivity by shifting to a different group of workers, and at least that's my fear. And one of the reasons we can't really present a range of the estimates, as the other speakers have said, is because we don't have any, because this is a really radical wage increase by past standards. You know, in many places, this would constitute a doubling of the effective minimum wage, and right. We just don't have those in our studies to make a prediction one way or the other.
Just about a minute left here. Alicia Sasser-Modestino, what are the opportunities beyond the minimum wage argument? What are the opportunities in the American labor market in the future, looking forward, looking on the horizon? What do you see?
Well, looking forward, I think that the opportunities are in education and training. I mean, I think that we have a couple different avenues we could be pursuing, right? If employers are not finding the workers that they want, they will take other measures. They will automate more jobs. They will offshore more jobs. And so we have a real obligation and a real reason to make sure that workers do have the right sets of skills that will meet up with jobs. And I think, you know, one of the things that we can think about in terms of the minimum wage debate is if we are going to see substantial job loss from a higher minimum wage, then perhaps along with increasing the minimum wage, there should be a provision in that bill for training for workers, you know, who are displaced by a higher minimum wage. Wouldn't that be better to train them for something that is not a minimum wage job?
Important issues here. Alicia Sasser-Modestino, professor of economics, public policy at Northeastern University here in Boston with me in the studio. Alicia, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Heather Boucher, executive director and chief economist at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. Thanks so much, Heather. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And Heather, Harry Holzer, senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution. Harry, thank you for being with us to speak about this important issue.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.